me read you a few words from my next guest that's taken from a doco about post-traumatic stress disorder in Iraq and Afghanistan, suffered by a huge number of war vets. If you murder someone, if you kill someone in this society, there's only two places you're going to go. You're going to go to jail for the rest of your life for a significant amount of time, or you're going to go to a mental institution for a long time. And the only people who are expected to kill on a daily basis and then adjust back to civilian life are, you know, veterans. This, to me, is crazy. Vincent Emanuele, former US Marine, served two tours in Iraq, refused a third, and instead became a warrior for peace. He's on the National Board of Directors of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and he hosts a weekly program on the wireless called Veterans Unplugged, and he joins me now in our Melbourne TARDIS. Welcome to our little wireless program, Vin.
Thanks for having me.
Reading about your return to civilian life reminds me of all things, of a deep-sea diver surfacing too quickly without the help of a decompression chamber. It was pretty tough, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I mean, as you had mentioned with the quote that you read before, you're asking young 18, 19-year-old men and women to be trained as killers for 3.5 months in Marine Corps boot camp, then another 8 weeks in infantry training for myself, and that at 18 years old, I was sent to Iraq during the initial invasion. And after having to participate in those things, actually having to use that training to actually kill someone, and then to have your best friends surrounding you also be killed, and to witness this and to participate in this and to have to live with this, as a young man, in my case, it was extremely traumatizing. And, you know, unfortunately, in the United States, there's a long history of veterans coming home not being taken care of. You know, so some of this goes all the way back to World War One.
Absolutely.
The Bonus Army March. And you remember the 45,000 veterans who camped out in Washington, D.C., demanding benefits and care for their service during World War One, all the way to the 1960s and 70s. Where veterans were coming home from Vietnam trying to get Agent Orange recognized, trying to get post-traumatic stress disorder recognized. And then now, with Iraq and Afghanistan, millions of veterans coming home to the United States, a place where, on average, any given night, there's 250,000 homeless veterans. The unemployment rate for veterans is twice that of the national average. Those numbers spike depending on whether or not you're African-American or Latin-American veteran. And for women veterans, one-third of whom are reporting military sexual trauma and or rape, the crisis is even more severe.
Politicians, of course, posture, hyperventilate patriotically, and then do bugger all. My oldest daughter was a psychiatrist in a vet's hospital, and she told me again and again what a hellhole it was. So even if you are given some help, it doesn't necessarily mean quality help. Taking part in the Iraq War therefore changed you profoundly. I understand that your girlfriend, who you'd left 8 months earlier, barely recognized the bloke you'd become.
Yes, it wasn't just the woman I was dating at the time. It was my parents, my friends. You know, you come back a profoundly changed individual, and as I've come to learn reading and researching more and more about post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, both conditions I have been diagnosed with by the Veterans Administration Hospital, your brain is not only psychologically changed, so your emotions and the way you process information, but it is physiologically changed. So now, you know, veterans who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, myself included, you know, you fall into a very dark, depressing hole and a lot of drinking.
But you did your best to handle it because you were reading books, you were writing poetry. As you say, you educated yourself to contextualize the events you'd witnessed.
Well, and that contextualization process was key for me. So, you know, in other words, there are veterans who come home and they don't go through that process. you know, falling into drinking or drugs or so forth, violence. But for myself, I have to admit as well that I was very privileged. I had very supportive family. You know, I had very supportive friends who didn't leave me when times got tough. And I also had folks surrounding me who were willing to engage me on a political level to try and challenge me, to get me to read about the history of U.S. foreign policy, to read about the history of veterans in the United States and the struggles that they've dealt with. So for me, it was a very cathartic experience to become politically engaged, to become creatively engaged, to start writing that poetry, to go out to protests and rallies and community meetings and to share my stories of being overseas with complete strangers. But strangers who in a room, you know, filled with anti-war activists had their best intentions at heart to try and prevent and or stop the current wars and future wars from happening. And so for me, it was absolutely cathartic to become involved with the anti-war movement.
No longer a high school jock and self-described ignorant kid, you were transformed. And of course, I understand that a huge percentage of vets returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are on psychotropic medication.
Yes, as a matter of fact, not just returning veterans, but 12% of those who are currently serving in Iraq, that's still security contractors, people who are within the embassy in the Green Zone in Baghdad, 12% of those and 12% of those who served in Iraq for the last 4 years are currently on psychotropic medications in the combat zone. And in Afghanistan, that number jumps to about 17%. So 17% of the American forces who are on the ground in Afghanistan, that's close to one-fifth of the forces in Afghanistan right now, are operating in a combat zone under the influence of psychotropic medication. And a lot of this is due to the fact that the United States military and government did not want to try and redesign conscription. They did not try and, you know, have a draft or ask the civilian population to chip in or to volunteer. What they're doing now, and I'm not saying that would have been the answer, but at the point I'm trying to make is that because the U.S. government didn't want to have a draft, because they knew that the war would have ended very quickly if a bunch of 18-year-olds in the United States were forced to go to Iraq and Afghanistan, as opposed to doing that, what they're doing now is sending young men and women on 2, 3, 4, 5, and in some cases 6 to 7 multiple deployments. And we have to remember that this is a new phenomena.
Well, it was a measure of the lack of intelligent preparation for the invasion. You know, there was tons of gear, tons of machines, tons of rockets and things that go bang. But when it came to boots on the ground, they really were, it was really thin picking. So people are forced back and back and back. Little wonder the suicide rate is much higher than the average in America. We've done programs on this in the past, Vincent, and it's horrific.
Well, it's not just America. I just read in The Guardian last week that Australian veterans are now killing themselves at 3 times the rate in which they died in the combat zone. So the Guardian article pointed out that as of now, today in 2014, there have been three times as many Australian veterans who have committed suicide than died in the combat zone. So it's obviously happening on a much larger scale in America because we had a much larger influx of troops, but the ratios are the same. And so I think this is also not only just an American problem, but this is an Australian problem, this is a British problem, and so forth.
And it sure as hell is an Iraqi problem. You agree with the figure that I've been using for years, 1 million Iraqis dead, 7 million displaced. A whole generation lost, because when you have a war for 7 years, kids don't go to school, and the country is full of depleted uranium.
Well, and it's not just the last 7 years. You know, if we really want to be honest about this, you know, from the British perspective or as an American, I think we all need to go back maybe 100 years, and I know we don't have time for that conversation, but British interests, imperial interests in the Middle East range far before right at the turn of the 20th century. Going, you know, more specifically to the American context, the United States has supported Saddam Hussein in the past, supported the Ba'athist Party throughout the late 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and then supported both sides in the 8-year war between Iraq and Iran from 1980 to 1988, then the Gulf War in 1991, then 10 years of sanctions under the Clinton administration, then the occupation of Iraq in 2003. So what we're talking about really is not just a generation of Iraqis who've had their lives destroyed, their culture destroyed, their nation destroyed. What we're truly talking about is several generations of Iraqis who have not had the dignity of sovereignty, have not had the dignity of living in a peaceful, prosperous nation because of the occupations and because of foreign meddling in their affairs.
I'm sure you realize, you well know, that Australians have saluted the American flag and gone off to basically your misbegotten wars, well, just about forever. And you've said in the past that the US military is a monstrosity. Now, we had a belated warning about the military-industrial complex from Eisenhower as he left office, but the monstrosity you describe creates further monstrosity, doesn't it?
Well, it not only creates further monstrosity, but as you well know, your former Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, a conservative, who's now in some ways understanding and I think honestly describing what the situation is with the United States. As brutal as our history has been, much like the Australian history, our country was built on the indigenous genocide. You know, it was built on the genocide of indigenous peoples and the theft of their land right throughout African American slavery, right throughout using immigrants from Asia to build the country, right throughout present day. Where we're using Latin American immigrants to perform menial economic tasks and to be paid less wages and so forth. What it ends up doing in a society like America is funneling trillions of dollars to the military-industrial complex while simultaneously the United States falls apart internally. So if you look at any economic or socioeconomic indicators in the United States, especially the reports released from the World Trade Organization, the World Health Organization, or other United Nations entities, the United States ranks dead last in almost every single category in the industrialized world. And not only in the industrialized world, but more often than not, some of these categories the United States is placed within, you know, the same category as Latvia, Romania, Bulgaria, so forth. And so as Martin Luther King mentioned in the 1960s, the United States is not only, you know, in the 1960s, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, but all of this has been multiplied since Dr. King's time. So when we're talking about a United States now, we're talking about 1,000 military bases worldwide. We're talking about 4 military operations per day taking place in the continent of Africa. We're talking about drone striking and meddling in Pakistan, Lebanon, Palestine, Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, threatening countries like Syria, threatening countries like Iran, threatening countries like North Korea. And now, as we all see, playing out in very catastrophic, what could be catastrophic ways in Crimea, around again with the Russians. And so I think, you know, people really need to understand that the United States is lashing out as an empire because its power is now dwindling. You know, the idea that the United States can continue to maintain a worldwide military empire without bankrupting the nation is completely contrary to the history of former empires and how they have been grown and how they have eventually fallen.
Ellen Nell on RN, and I'm talking to Iraq war veteran and now, as I said, warrior for peace, Vincent Emanuele. You mentioned Malcolm Fraser in passing. He's also gone through a transformation like your own, because when I first met Malcolm, he was a great enthusiast for Ayn Rand, but nowadays he'd recognises that he was in error. You have never been convinced war was the solution to anything, have you?
No, and a lot of this has to do with my, you know, my Italian father, and you know, coming from this background of, you know, growing up around street hoodlums and growing up in a steel mill town, blue collar town, kind of rough, some crime, a lot of fights, a lot of drinking at the bars after guys get off from the mill. My family dealing with, you know, being first, second generation Italian immigrants coming to America, dealing with that process. And, you know, my dad always told me, he was like, Vince, you know, these politicians, these judges, all these folks that are talking to you, he's like, you know, these folks aren't telling you the truth. You got to understand that sometimes these people are full of crap. And, you know, that sort of simplistic elementary street knowledge carried a long way with me. So when I finally got to the military and when I was finally deployed to Iraq, I was looking at the situation. I'm going, wait a minute, these generals, these lieutenant colonels, these majors, these captains, they're not out in the field every day. They're not the ones patrolling the streets. They're not the ones asked to go search people. They're not the ones asked to set up vehicle checkpoints or to kick in people's doors or to possibly have to deal with the aftermath of an improvised explosive device and pick up some little kid's arms or pick up the local shopkeeper's body because it had been blown to 100 pieces in the middle of the road. These people never had to deal with that. And so when I looked at that, I had to ask myself, wait a minute, you know, are all these same dynamics that my dad was telling me about in society, they're playing out in the military? So when I saw us, you know, shooting at and killing innocent Iraqis, and then thinking about, well, wait a minute, what would I do? What would Australians do? What would the person who's listening to this program do if a foreign occupying force came to your house, came to your town, destroyed your environment, destroyed your hospitals, destroyed your economy, destroyed your schools, and then on top of that, maybe beat up, tortured, raped, or killed one of your family members? How would you react to that? And so for me, it was this very primal, very basic, you know, as they tell you in kindergarten, put yourself in the other person's shoes and see how you would react to that same situation or try and empathize.
How difficult was it to raise the concerns that developed in your psyche about what you were seeing and participating in while you were in Iraq? Were you in trouble?
Well, I expressed myself quite openly towards the end of my second deployment. And it did get me in trouble. It got me the worst duty stations. It got me out on more patrols that could possibly have had me killed. And then that changed to, well, we don't want him around the other guys because we don't want him, you know, sort of spewing his political opinions or so forth or trying to change people's minds. So let's just isolate him. You know, so then they gave me, you know, menial tasks like, hey, fill sandbags for the next 8 hours and then go stand post by yourself. Or, hey, go clean the garbage cans out or go clean the latrines out. Those were the kind of tasks they were giving me towards the end, not to mention I had people in the command who were threatening to put me in the brig for the rest of my life as a traitor. There were people who said that what I was saying and what I was participating in or what I wanted to participate in was treasonous, and that you know, I had one staff sergeant tell me that the penalty could be death just for having these kinds of opinions. So it was anything
You weren't a poster boy, were you, for
No,
American
not at
military.
All. You know what's funny about that? I should at least tell you this because it's kind of a funny side story. There was a gunnery sergeant who I'll never forget who saw me with a John Kerry sticker on my backpack, John Kerry running for president in 2004. And he said, you know what? He used to call me Emanuele, as everyone's referred to in the military. He said, you know what, Emanuele? You want to be a traitor like John Kerry? Don't you realize that he testified to Congress against his brothers and sisters? Well, no less than 4 years after Gunnery Sergeant Patterson told me this, I was sitting in front of Congress testifying about my experiences in Iraq. So that for me was this like full circle process of being called a traitor in 2004 and then performing the exact same event that John Kerry participated in.
I occasionally award a high honor to guests, and you've just won a koala stamp. So, look, I've been arguing for decades that we should distance ourselves from the American alliance, and the aforementioned Malcolm Fraser has recently published a book on what is laughingly described as Australia's foreign policy, and he wants us to break the alliance with the US and become a strategically independent country. Now, this would mean ending, for example, the US presence in northern Australia, part of the American pivot to the region. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, interestingly enough, I'm going to meet with Malcolm Fraser tomorrow. So after he does a book launch in Melbourne, we have a private meeting set up in the afternoon. So I'll be looking forward to having this conversation with him, and I'm currently trying to finish his book as we speak. Not as we speak. I'm not reading it as we're talking. But, you know, I'm trying to finish it as soon as possible. And I think he makes some really great points. I think the most important point to remember, and I just explained this to the MUA union that I was speaking with today in Melbourne, is that Australian and American tax dollars are now supporting some of the worst regimes in the Middle East. And so for folks who are involved in union struggle, you know, I mentioned to these union folks that their tax dollars are going to support a Maliki government in Iraq that has outlawed unions. So, you know, how that sits with them is, of course, not very well, but also for the regular Australian citizen. I mean, you go back all the way, you know, following the English Empire into wars, following the American Empire into wars. Of course, it's not beneficial for the people of Australia. And I think Fraser makes the really prescient point that in a changing geopolitical global landscape, where your economic partners are largely based in the Southern Pacific, Why would Australia as a state, or why would the people of Australia as citizens and members of that state, want to align themselves with what's considered in poll after poll after poll, year after year, as being the number one threat to peace in the world? And that's the United States. And so, you know, Obama's pivot to Asia, as we see with the signing in the Philippines of new troop agreements, base extensions, and then Obama stumping in Malaysia the day after for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has been referred to as NAFTA on steroids. The notion that Australians would want anything to do with a containment policy concerning China, I think is completely in line with you know, the economic interests of Australia. But not only that, the interests of living in a peaceful Southern Pacific region that is not constantly embroiled in U.S. occupations.
We've got to wind it up, Vincent. Vincent Emanuele, former U.S. Marine and now, as you've heard, a traitor who serves on the National Board of Directors of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He'll be giving a public lecture in Melbourne this coming Thursday between 6:30 and 8:30 at the RMIT Swanston Academic Building 80. Oh, and in Sydney on Sunday the 11th of May between 4 and 7 at the Addison Road Community Centre, Addison Road, Marrickville. And we'll put those details on our website. Thanks, Finn. On our next, I'll be talking to Bruce Shapiro about the disunited States of America. And we'll hear about the murder of a young Ugandan politician who'd been in Parliament for only 22 months. The news is next. I'll talk to you again in 23 hours.